presented by the American Petroleum Institute.
Speech that is critical of Israel alone does not constitute unlawful discrimination.
Jerry Nadler, who has represented a big piece of Manhattan since 1992, is one of the longest-serving Jewish members of the House. He's also a Columbia University alum. He was on campus in 1968 when police cleared Hamilton Hall of anti-Vietnam War protesters. He is a close observer of the Middle East and the politics of Israel in the U.S., and he's the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, where he's long seen himself as a champion of civil liberties. All of this background helped put Nadler at the center of a swirl of events this week, as pro-Palestinian protesters at Columbia were ejected from Hamilton Hall, as President Biden made his first public remarks about campus protests, as a ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel seemed tantalizingly close, and as the House passed, by an overwhelming majority of 320 to 91, the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, a bill against which Nadler led the opposition.
By encompassing purely political speech about Israel into Title VI's ambit, the bill sweeps too broadly.
We're going to talk to the congressman about all of this, and about Trump's interview in Time magazine, the potential for disruption at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, the vote Nadler most regrets in his long career, and the nature of truth. I'm Ryan Lizza, and this is Playbook Deep Dive. Let's start with what happened yesterday with the vote on the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act of 2023. You voted against it and you made
I led the opposition.
You made a very strong statement on the floor. The act adopts the definition of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's
known as definition. IRA.
Of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that definition, what the intention of this legislation was, and why you think it's such a bad idea.
Well, there are three extant definitions. One is by IRA, one is the Nexus definition, and the other is the Jerusalem definition. They're all equally valid. They all give different examples for perceptions of anti-Semitism, and none of them should be enshrined into law. The chief author of the IRA definition, Kenneth Stern, said, don't codify this. Don't make it part of any law. Because these are examples that may indicate anti-Semitism, but don't necessarily in every case. And to enshrine it into law, he thought, and a lot of other people think, would be destructive of free speech. It could make criticism under certain circumstances of Israeli government policy, anti-Semitic, which it clearly isn't. So the American Civil Liberties Union is against it. National Jewish groups that oppose this bill because it undermines free speech. J Street, Americans for Peace Now, Aleph, Alliance for Jewish Renewal, Bend the Arc, Jewish Action, New Israel Fund, Partners for Progressive Israel, Reconstructing Judaism, and True are the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. All these are Jewish groups that oppose codifying this, that is to say, they oppose the legislation as violative of free speech, in addition to the ACLU.
Just to back up a little, explain to listeners what the point of the bill is. The point is to change the Civil Rights Act and to give guidance to the Department of Education.
No, the point is to define anti-Semitism.
For what purpose, bill, though?
I suppose the purpose is to make it easier for the Office of Civil Rights to enforce the law, but the bill, for reasons unknown to me, enshrines the IRA definition and says disregard the other two. There's no rational reason for that. They're all equally valid. They're all made by committees of scholars and experts on anti-Semitism, and so I don't understand that. Second of all, if you want to fight anti-Semitism through Congress, there are two things you can do. There is a bicameral, bipartisan bill, the Manning Bill, co-sponsored by many, many Democrats and Republicans in the House and in the Senate, to set up a whole-of-government approach to anti-Semitism, which makes far more sense, doesn't violate civil liberties. The other thing you should do is increase the budget for OCR. The Office of Civil Rights is in charge of enforcing Title VI, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, etc., on college campuses. Because of the huge increase in anti-Semitism, the Biden administration last year for the fiscal year 2024 budget asked for a 25% increase in the OCR budget to enforce strictures against anti-Semitism. The Republicans pushed for a 25% cut in that budget, mostly, I think, because they were afraid it might be used not only against anti-Semitism, but against anti-LGBTQ prejudice. The result was that the funding stayed flat despite the need for an increase because of the increase in anti-Semitism. We're repeating the same fight now for the FY25 budget, which is under discussion now. So if you want to fight anti-Semitism, you pass the Manning Bill or something like it, and you increase the budget, the enforcement budget against anti-Semitism, which is the OCR, none of which the Republicans are doing, quite the opposite. Instead, they're doing performative bills like this, which do nothing, do nothing at all. They're just political gestures to make it seem like they're doing something, and doing something at the expense of free speech, which is why I led the opposition.
Can you explain to our listeners where these lines fade into one another? What these competing definitions try to get at?
But
the idea is that it sweeps up anti-Israel or anti-Zionist speech.
Yes, that is the problem. That is the problem. And that's why the author of the IRA definition, which the Lawler Bill would enshrine into law, says don't put this in law.
You did support a previous version of this bill. And I believe in the back and forth this week, you said that that was a mistake. Tell us about what happened there.
I supported the previous version of the bill, I think 7 or 8 years ago. And it was different, first of all. Unlike this bill, it didn't exclude the other two definitions, which makes it better than this bill. But also, I was probably mistaken 8 years ago.
You wouldn't support that one again.
No, I would not.
In general, you think it's a
better. It's better than this one, but I still wouldn't support it again.
Yeah, the free speech problems are the stumbling block here.
Right.
All right. So, 70 Democrats and 21 Republicans opposed the legislation.
Yes.
Are you disappointed in how many, including most of the Democratic leadership, supported this?
No, I'm not. I am delighted we got 70 Democratic no votes. It's more than I expected. It's very easy to support something that claims to be against anti-Semitism, and it's hard to start explaining to your constituents the nuances of why you didn't. So
you're being generous to the folks who supported this with an understanding of the politics.
I assume some really did it on the merits, quite a few, I assume. But also, politically, it's much easier. Someone said that when you're explaining, you're losing. That's a political maxim. It's not always true, but it's much easier to vote for something like this than it is to vote against it.
Well, and I'm curious about the politics for you, and you represent basically all of the middle of Manhattan. You're one of the longest serving Jewish representatives. You have a lot of constituents that I imagine support this legislation. What's the reaction been in Manhattan?
I haven't seen a reaction yet. I assume I will. But I've taken unpopular stances before. I was the only Jewish member in the tri-state region to buck every single Jewish organization and support the Iran deal. I think I was proven right. And I had a primary as a result of it. I did very well in that primary. You know, if you're serving in public office, you have to do it for the right reasons. And you can't only be a slave to re-election. You have to vote your conscience and hope that you can explain it to your constituents.
You went to Columbia University, Congressman. You were
in
1968.
I certainly was.
When Hamilton Hall was occupied. It's one of the more famous times it was. Tell us a little bit about being at Columbia back then in 68 and what you remember from that historic event.
Well, I was off campus much of the year campaigning for Gene McCarthy in various different primaries.
Okay. What year were you then? You were a senior?
No, I was a junior.
You were a junior. Okay.
And I came back to campus on April 23rd after the Pennsylvania primary. And that was the first day of the occupation of Hamilton Hall. And by the way, they occupied a number of buildings, not just Hamilton Hall. And they kept the dean, Dean Coleman, hostage for 26 hours. And although I agreed with some of the positions that the SDS, the Students for Democratic Society, who were leading this, were taking, I decided immediately that I could not support occupation of the buildings because I thought it violated the civil liberties of students and faculty who want to go to classes. And you're entitled to express your opinion and so forth, but you're not entitled to stop other people from doing what they wanted. After about a week, on April 30th, the university called in the police. And unlike this time, the police staged a riot. They came in club swinging. And I was actually off campus in my apartment on 107th in Manhattan with my roommate. As soon as we heard the bus was started, we ran up to campus. And I observed police dragging kids down the steps in front of Lowell Library by the feet with their head banging on every concrete step. I observed cops on horseback swinging a club at anybody who they could, even on Broadway. I avoided getting clubbed because I had the presence of mind to step between two cars and watch it so they couldn't. People were so enraged by that there was a meeting called the next night at Woman Auditorium. There were 800 students there, and I was there. And I was totally unknown in terms of my campus politics because my politics were off campus entirely. But I went to that meeting, and immediately there was a decision to form a strike committee and have what we referred to as the second strike. And the decision was taken that every 70 students who would participate in the strike could elect one delegate to the strike committee. And the question then arose, who should be entitled to vote? I got up to speak, and when it became apparent that I was saying that anyone who agreed to abide by the decisions of the strike committee should be able to vote, the first two rows got up and started to drown me out. And I got elected a delegate from the Columbia University Student Senate, which I had nothing to do with, but I got elected a delegate anyway in the strength of my speech that night. But after a while, we started figuring out who our allies were, and eventually we started winning the votes. When we started winning the votes, they started ignoring the instructions of the strike committee and doing what they wanted, what the SDS wanted. So I said we should walk off the strike committee as noisily and messily as possible, form our own strike committee, let the SDS have an ideologically pure strike of 500 kids. We'd have a strike of 5,000 and we could negotiate with the administration. And people were horrified. They said, my God, you'd be breaking strike unity. And I said, damn straight. You can't have unity with totalitarians. So eventually we did walk out. We've ended up negotiating with the administration. I think we called ourselves Students for a Restructured University, the SRU. And after a while, I thought the issues weren't that important, and I got back into the McCarthy campaign.
Yeah. So you have a long history with the school. You went there. You've represented it on and off. Tell us about, and look, I don't know if you've been following with a lot of detail the evolution of the campus protests, but what's your opinion of them been?
Well, I have been following it only from the news. Obviously, there's been very strong demonstrations there. Obviously, there's been a lot of anti-Semitism, too. Obviously, it has frightened Jewish students and intimidated them, which is wrong. And I'm glad the university finally decided enough was enough.
So you think the university handled it appropriately?
Yes, I do.
This week? You think?
Yes, I do. They especially after the occupation of Hamilton Hall.
Yeah.
When that occurred, until then, you could say, well, they're not totally interfering with classroom instruction, et cetera. But once you occupied Hamilton Hall, you were interfering with classroom instruction, you were interfering with exams, and you cannot permit a minority of students to interfere with the core educational mission of the university and with the education of the students. So I think Columbia had no choice but to call in the police and to evacuate Hamilton Hall.
President Biden spoke today, just a little while before we're speaking here, Congressman, about the protests. He seemed to try to balance support for the right of the protesters to speak out with condemnation of the lawbreaking. He said there's a right to protest, but there is not a right to cause chaos. Did you get to see or read his comments, and what was your reaction?
No, I didn't, but as you quote them right now, he's exactly right. There's a right to protest. There is not a right to interfere with other people's activities. There's not a right to intimidate students, Jewish or otherwise. There is a right to express your opinions.
Do you think he should have spoken out earlier, as a lot of Republicans, including Donald Trump, it seems like, wanted him to do this week?
I don't know. I mean, the timing is very difficult. The Republicans are being total hypocrites about it because, on the one hand, they're saying that the president of Columbia should resign. I don't know what they think she should have done that she didn't do. And they're talking about anti-Semitism while indulging in anti-Semitism. I mean, Donald Trump has made anti-Semitic comments. It goes right up to date. Charlottesville was, there were fine people on both sides. Even this past week, I think he said something to that effect. He's been meeting with known anti-Semites to date, and they don't say anything. So they hardly have clean hands, to put it mildly. In fact, they have filthy hands.
For nearly 4 years, the American people have faced the pain of high inflation and global conflict. Now, more than ever, it's time to end political gamesmanship and implement policies that help benefit Americans. Let's work together on solutions that help address the consequences of inflation and secure our energy future. Visit lightsonenergy.com/energyleadership to learn more.
All right, let's talk about a less controversial, simpler subject, and that is Middle East peace.
Mm-hmm.
We're all waiting to see if Hamas's final reaction to the current deal that's on the table. I'm curious how you think the Biden administration has handled things in recent weeks, and what you think of the current state of these talks.
I think the Biden administration has handled things as well as they can be handled. Hamas is obviously terrible. I think Netanyahu is doing everything he can to sabotage the peace talks, even at the cost of the hostages. He has every motive for keeping the war going as long as possible. Because when the war is over, number one, there'll be a commission of inquiry. Number two, there'll be an election, and he's polling at about 20%. And number three, he'll have to face the felony charges that are outstanding against him. He's insisting on this Rafah operation, which is absurd and which would sabotage, as Blinken and the president have said, would sabotage any hopes of peace. And I say it's absurd because Netanyahu says there were 12 battalions of Hamas and we have defeated 8. We got to go into the south and defeat the other 4. But meanwhile, the Israelis are fighting up north with Hamas, where they cleared it. You can't defeat that kind of an enemy that way, as we discovered in Mosul, and for that matter in Vietnam. The proper thing to do is exactly what the Biden administration is pushing, namely, don't go into Rafah, negotiate a ceasefire deal in which Arab troops from Saudi Arabia, the UAE, other places come in and occupy Gaza, start rebuilding it and so forth, and have work and have them work with the PA, with the Palestinian Authority, to reform it so that you can eventually, and this will take years, but eventually have a Palestinian Authority in charge of Gaza and the West Bank and have a two-state solution. Now, Netanyahu does not want a two-state solution, and this is something else he's going to have to answer for once this war is over to the Israeli public. He was telling Qatar to fund Hamas before the war started. Why? Because he wanted Hamas to be in opposition to the Palestinian Authority so they couldn't be a two-state solution. And of course, it blew up in his face.
He wanted the extremists to be the face of Palestinian statehood.
Not so much that. He wanted them to be separated.
It was a divide and conquer, yeah.
Well, not to divide and conquer, but to prevent the emergence ever of a Palestinian state.
Given the, right, by exacerbating those divisions?
Yes. He will also, by the way, when the war is over, he'll also have to face a few other questions.
Go ahead.
Israel is the size of New Jersey. Israel was attacked on October 7th. Why did it take the IDF 12 hours to respond? Yes, he had removed one of the brigades from Gaza and sent it to the West Bank. Fine. The West Bank is 60 miles away. Why did it take the IDF 12 hours to respond? That is also something he's going to have to answer for.
Do you believe that it was a tactical military mistake, or are you suggesting that he invited this because it would help him politically?
No, I don't think he invited the attack. I don't think he anticipated the attack. But he helped create the conditions for it by telling Qatar to fund Hamas.
There is a debate over whether to call Netanyahu's war and the results of that war in Gaza a genocide or not. Some of your House Democratic colleagues have said that it is. A lot of the protesters around the country use that language. What's your opinion of that?
It's absolutely invalid. It is not a genocide. It is not approaching a genocide. A genocide is the intentional eradication or extermination of a group of people, of an identifiable group, in this case, presumably the Palestinians. There are a lot of casualties among the Palestinians. One might criticize the Israeli conduct of the war in terms of causing more casualties than needed. And that may be. But that's not a genocide.
So as much as you dislike Netanyahu, think he is, as you've said in the past, one of the worst leaders, not just of Israel, but of the Jewish people.
Yes.
That goes back a long way.
I think he's got only one competitor for the worst Jewish leader in history, and that would be the Hasmonean king, who in the first century BC, in order to help him in a factional dispute, invited in the Romans.
That's all right. That was quite a while ago. So that bad. But as bad as you think he is, you don't accuse him of committing a genocide against
not at all
against the Palestinian people.
No,
the ICC seems interested in perhaps issuing arrests for Israeli leaders, and the Biden administration is behind the scenes trying to make that not happen because they think it could completely scuttle the very delicate, fragile peace negotiations that are on the table. Do you think that's the right thing to do here?
Yes, I think that's exactly the right thing to do. Such things could not help but scuttle peace negotiations, and I don't see anything constructive it could do.
I want to talk a little bit more about potential Middle East breakthroughs. As part of this larger deal, I think the theory of the Biden administration is you get this ceasefire, and then you push forward the larger regional deal between Saudi, the U.S.,
yes,
and Israel. But I want to, and all the reporting is that Biden officials say they're very close to an agreement with Saudi Arabia that would provide U.S. weapons, a security guarantee to Saudi, and assistance in building a domestic nuclear program. Do you think the U.S. should be rewarding Saudi Arabia in this way after Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi?
Yes, I think you have to work with what you have. It's true that Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, does not have clean hands in a lot of different things. But to create a new Middle Eastern peace structure, if it's necessary to work with him, it's necessary to work with him. In foreign policy, you have to work with a lot of people who you don't like on other bases. To set up that peace structure, which would cement peace in the Middle East for a long time, and also cement an alliance against potential Iranian aggression, is a very worthy objective and makes a lot of sense.
I mean, the second part of this, of course, there's the U.S.-Saudi part, but then, of course, the Saudi-Israel part, where Saudi recognizes Israel. It doesn't seem like they would recognize Israel unless they see a credible path to a Palestinian state. Do you see any prospect for that happening? I've been surprised at how much of the coverage of this makes it sound like this is on the verge of happening, this entire normalization agreement.
This could happen. It may have to wait for Netanyahu to be out. But this could happen. It's certainly in the Saudi interest. It's in the Israeli interest. It's in the interest of everybody in the Middle East, basically, Egyptian, everybody except for Iran and its proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis. It's in everybody's interest. Saudi Arabia can't do it as long as their population is inflamed against Israel too much, which is why, again, this war has to end.
Do you think, all right, if we take the most optimistic scenario, and I know that's never a good idea in the Middle East, which is you get a ceasefire, the Saudis and the U.S. move ahead with their portion of the agreement. I don't know what the next step is, but somehow the Saudis do recognize Israel with the understanding that there's a path to a Palestinian state. Those dominoes fall. I think this is a very, very optimistic scenario, but is one that's being talked about by serious people. And if we start to see that as a real possibility, do you think that would sort of defang the protests in the United States?
Oh, I think it would. I think once the fighting is over, the protests will be defanged.
Do you worry about the convention this summer in Chicago? A little too on the nose that you guys decided to do it in Chicago this year.
Yes, too evocative.
I don't know how much you talk to people who are planning the convention, but do you worry about what that could look like if this war is still going on and if this protest movement?
Well, I haven't talked to people planning the convention at all, but yes, I worry about it. I don't think it's equivalent to what happened in Chicago in 1968 for a number of reasons. First of all, the atmosphere was completely different. This was an American war we were talking about. American boys were being drafted. I was active with Al Lowenstein in the Dump Johnson movement, that is to deny Johnson renomination because of the war. And this was seen at the time as impossible. You could defeat a president, and we eventually did. We forced them out. But I remember talking to a fellow student on campus at about that time and saying, why do you hate Lyndon Johnson? And his reply was, because he wants to kill me.
So it was personal.
It was personal. because it was an American war, the American draft. People felt personally threatened. There's no such thing now. Completely different. We're talking about a foreign war. No one in the United States feels threatened. Now, clearly, there are Palestinian Americans who have family there, and
right, it's personal for them.
It's personal for them, but that's not most people, obviously. It's a very small percentage of the American population. But the other thing is that made Chicago particularly terrible then was that Mayor Daley's cops staged a riot. They were beating up the demonstrators in full view of the television cameras. Presumably, this time, the police in Chicago will handle themselves professionally, as the police in New York and in other places have done. And so I think it's very different. Now, it obviously does have an impact on the election. But I think for young people, especially, if the Biden campaign does its job at all, people are going to see, wait a minute, do I want freedom of choice for women? Or do I want the state monitoring pregnant women? Do I want student debt erased? Do I want a world I can live in with the climate crisis? Do I want to support LGBTQ issues? Do I want democracy after what Trump has said, made very clear about how he'll destroy democracy in this country? Besides what I said a moment ago, when you read Trump's interview in Time Magazine, et cetera, he really wants to set up an autocracy in this country. And I assume that the Biden campaign will do a competent job in getting that out between now and Election Day.
There are two follow-ups on that. One is, how do you think domestic U.S. politics might affect Netanyahu's decision-making? As we talked about before, you think it's certainly in his political interest for this war to continue. If he wants President Biden to lose the election, it would also be in his political interest.
I certainly think he wants President Biden to lose the election. The Diaspora Affairs Minister Chikli, whose first name I forget, who's a member of Netanyahu's party, the Likud, not one of the more extreme party in the even more extreme parties in the coalition, said as much. He said, "We want Biden." He said, "We want Trump." I don't remember if he said we or I. Want Trump reelected. For an ally to intervene in American politics like that is incredible. But Bibi's done this before. Remember the disrespect he showed to Obama.
Oh yeah.
When he came and spoke to the Congress at Boehner's invitation against Obama's policy on the Iran deal.
Yeah.
So I think Bibi has his own political interests, and if it helps Trump win re-election, so much the better from his point of view.
The relationship between Obama and Bibi was pretty bad by the end of Obama's term. Biden came in with a longer relationship with Bibi and adopted this hug Bibi strategy that you had to hug him. It's the only way to influence him when things go south. Do you think that strategy was the correct one?
I think it was the only one available.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the alternative was to be a little bit tougher from the beginning.
Well, I don't know how he could have been tougher initially. I think he's been very tough now in the war. The only way he could be tougher, if Bibi continues to disregard him, is to withhold offensive weapons.
Where are you on that one?
Well, I would defer to the president's judgment on that, but it may be necessary. Offensive, not defensive.
Of course.
You have to have the anti-missiles and so forth.
Am I correct that that's quite a bridge for you to cross, to be saying that, given your record of support for Israel and for aid to Israel?
Yes.
Speaking of Trump, you mentioned the Time magazine article. You have raised the alarm about him for many years and think it would be pretty disastrous for him to be president again. You've been very clear about that. But was there anything in that article that caused further concern to you?
Well, the article just made very clear what was implied till now. I mean, he said in so many words that he would instruct the Department of Justice to go after political enemies, that he would fire a U.S. attorney who refused to do so. This goes against the entire grain of American law enforcement since George Washington. He said he would pardon all the January 6th convictees. He would turn American government into a private tyranny in many different ways. He said he would support states keeping tabs of women's pregnancies. So it would be very dystopian. And he said he would use the National Guard to enforce what he thought was law in local cities, even against the will of the governor and the mayor. In other words, he's going to take over law enforcement. That's a formula for taking control away from the voters and vesting it in one man.
So in the House, Democratic leadership has come out with implicit support for Speaker Mike Johnson, who is Trump's close ally and has not spoken out about any of the things on your list right there. And of course, this is in the context of the Marjorie Taylor Greene motion to vacate. And it's not clear to me that the Democrats are going to get anything for this.
No.
What's the deal? Is this a deal worth making?
It's not a deal.
Do you support it?
It's not a deal. And I spoke in favor of this in caucus.
Tell us a little bit about the debate in caucus.
There wasn't much debate. Most people said, let's do this.
All right. And what'd you say?
I said, let's do that. There may have been one or two speakers against it. I don't really remember. But
would from the left, I assume?
Yeah, saying he was a terrible guy, et cetera. Yeah. Well, no one disputes that. From my point of view, he's a terrible guy. But the reason we ought to vote to table a motion to vacate is that the motion to vacate would be to take away the speakership because he did the right thing. Now, we oppose him in everything else. We're going to try our mightiest to make Hakeem Jeffries the next speaker. But you can't permit the ultra-right wing, the Putin wing of the Republican Party, which is what Mike McCall, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, the Republican chairman, called them, to punish the speaker for doing the right thing on Ukraine. And that's why we'll do this. Now, McCarthy did the right thing on the debt ceiling, and we did not save him because he lied to us. He was very dishonest.
When you say he's terrible, I just want to ask you, do you mean specifically because of all of the policy positions that you vehemently disagree with?
Yes.
But in terms of his character as a person, what's your opinion of him?
He's a very nice guy. He's an honest guy. I have no criticism of him on that basis. He's someone I profoundly disagree with on everything. Period.
But big difference in terms of the character and honesty between him and Kevin McCarthy.
Kevin McCarthy, when the chips were down, showed that he was dishonest, yes. Which is why we did not vote against the motion to vacate.
And he'd been there a while. It seems like there was a lot of history that made it very, very difficult for anyone to stomach saving him. You're going to be 77 next month.
Mm-hmm.
You recently said that you want 10 more years in office. I'm curious, though. Age is a big issue these days in our politics. As someone who's getting close to the age of our two presidential candidates, but is still a young man by those standards, how has age affected you and your ability to govern and to think and make decisions? What has it done to you? How are you different than when you were a younger politician?
I'm not aware that I am.
I mean, I assume there's upside and downside.
Well, the upside is that I have the seniority and the experience, and they're both very valuable, obviously. I mean, I've been in public office. I've been in the House now. It's my 32nd year. I was in the Assembly for 16 years before that, State Assembly. So I have a lot of experience at how to get things done. And the seniority obviously is helpful.
And I plan to serve as long as I feel I can do the job and as long as my constituents will have me.
What's your view of this debate about Biden and age?
I have no opponent this year, by the way. First year in 10 years, I haven't had a primary opponent. I do have a Republican opponent, of course, but that's not significant in this district.
What is it like in a year when you don't have a primary opponent and you have some of these tough votes? Is it just completely freeing? Is it like psychologically? Is it just like, wow, I can do whatever the hell I want?
Well, not really. I mean, there's always the possibility next time. And I've taken controversial positions over the years.
We talked about Iran before.
I was about to say, yeah. The one time I really thought I was taking my political life in my hands was the Iran vote. Because I watched as one by one, every Jewish organization, from the most conservative to the most liberal, came out against it. I watched as every Jewish member in the tri-state area, one by one, came out against it. And I concluded that I had to do what I thought was the right thing. And I still remember, as I was thinking about the pros and cons in each argument, argument A but B, argument C but D, I would put that down. And I ended up with a 5,200-word document leading me to the conclusion. And I decided what I was going to do. And I remember sitting at the, we were going to post it on Medium, and I remember sitting at the computer, or whatever it was, and my chief of staff at the time, Amy, saying to me, "Are you sure you want to push that button?" And I finally said, "Yeah," and I did. And I thought, you know, when push came to shove, it's better to risk your political career than to do something which you thought, which I thought, could endanger Israel's existence, could endanger the, you know, could lead to Iran becoming a nuclear power. I mean, if you can't do what you think is right, then ultimately you have no business in this business.
I always think it's interesting to ask a member of Congress, especially one like you, who's been around since a while. You were elected in 92, right?
Yes.
Is there a single vote? If you could take one vote back, is there one that sticks out in your mind?
Yes.
What is it?
In 1998 or 99, I voted to repeal the Glass-Steagall Act. I bought into the Clinton administration's anti-regulatory propaganda, and I think that was a bad mistake.
Very, very interesting. The last question on this show, Congressman, is always something that was proposed by our last guest, who didn't know that you were going to be the guest this week. And then while you're thinking about this, I want you to come up with a question for next week's guest, who you also don't know who that will be. So last week we had a bit of an unusual show. It was the actor from the movie Civil War. Have you seen Civil War?
Yes, I did.
All right. So you remember the Reuters journalist, the younger male character, his real life name is Wagner Moura. And this was his question. This was in the context of talking about journalism and the lack of truth these days and polarization. And he asks, what is truth for you? What is the truth and what's the importance of the truth nowadays in this polarized world with different narratives?
Well, narratives aside, there is objective truth about events in the past. There's also objective truth about what people say about the future. It is objectively true that Trump has said what he would do as president. It is objectively true what he did as president. There are objectively truthful things. Untruthful things are the opposite. When you say things that didn't happen, happened, or vice versa. Period.
Do you think that this is a problem right now in our politics, this sort of breakdown in consensus truth?
Yeah, I do. Because there are so many outlets that we now know lie for political reasons, like news, and which have been shown in defamation lawsuits to lie, like Newsmax, like Fox News, like OAN. We also know that a lot of people get their political facts from TikTok. And that has no relationship to the truth whatsoever. In fact, one could argue, and I've seen good arguments, that that is ultimately controlled by the Chinese. And in fact, the head of Axel Springer was in my office the other day, and he said that a lot of this pro-Hamas stuff now that we see from younger people is because of deliberate Chinese propaganda through the agency of TikTok. Whether that's true or not, I can't say. But certainly, when you get your news from TikTok, it's completely unreliable. There are no journalistic standards.
All right, well, give us a question for someone next week. It can be as broad or specific as you want. There really are no rules.
Let me think a moment. I'll give you a very broad question. What do you think is the future of democracy in this country?
That's a good one. Thank you so much for your time and a great discussion. I really appreciate it, Congressman.
You're quite welcome.
And that's our show. Our producer is Kara Tabor. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Thank you to Philip Probos for editing assistance and Joe Dobkin for field production in New York. Tell us what you think about the show or who you'd like to hear on Deep Dive. You can email me at rlizza@politico.com. And please subscribe to Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.